the Girl Crush Podcast.
Some theme music.
Kate Winslet micro expressions, 1800s teen angst.
She is one of the most humble people.
I love the character growth.
She's award winning, well known.
Yeah.
I love this.
She's 100% this character.
She has this gumption.
Off the charts.
She is amazing.
Oh, so classic.
Bold, valiant, daring.
So much grit.
A lot of tears, a lot of boobs.
A life lesson, you know? A life lesson from Kate Winslet.
Yes.
Hello, and welcome to the Girl Crush Podcast. I'm Anne.
And I'm Allie.
We love Kate Winslet, so this season we're watching all of her movies and ranking them. If you want to give us your own thoughts, be sure to connect with us on Instagram at girlcrush_pod, and as always, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe.
On today's episode, we're excited to be doing a double episode that we will deem Kate Winslet's 1600/1700s films, covering both A Little Chaos, which is also known as The King's Gardens, and the movie Quills. So we'll start with A Little Chaos, which was released in 2014, and Kate Winslet plays a character named Sabine DeBara. And in this movie, Sabine is a bit of an outspoken garden designer, for 1682 anyway, and is hired to design and build an outdoor ballroom in the Versailles Garden. You can rent this movie on Amazon Prime. If you haven't seen it, now is the time to pause and go watch, because from here on out, there will be spoilers. And I would say I enjoyed the movie.
I enjoyed this movie as well.
Yeah. You should watch it.
Yeah.
If you like period pieces and you like Kate Winslet.
Yeah. And Alan Rickman, the late and great, is also in this. So.
Yes. That's definitely a plus.
Yes. In we go. So for the plot of A Little Chaos, we gave this a 7 out of 10. We are in Paris in 1682, and we get a quick intro to our two primary characters, King Louis XIV, played by Alan Rickman, and Sabine, played by Kate. She's drawing in a garden. We also meet André Le Notre. Notre?
Probably.
Notre?
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 Yeah, like Notre Dame without the Dame.
When I tell you I speak no French.
Oh, man. Have you been to France?
No.
I have, and it was like the most embarrassed I've ever been.
Because like, of the language?
Because of the language, because I know no French. Like, I studied Spanish in high school, and so I know no French. And I was trying to be respectful and I wanted to like try, you know, so I tried to learn a little bit before we went, like some common phrases. And I was especially conscious of knowing that sometimes Americans are frustrating to the French or to anyone abroad when we just go in and try and speak English. So I'm trying and I don't even know the basics of when I read a French word, like what to do with the letters. You know what I mean? Like I have no idea. So I was just butchering it. But I would be like willing to try, whereas Kale would be like way more nervous to actually try, but he like could understand how to pronounce the words. So I was like, you need to be doing this, not me.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, Notre, maybe.
No, that's what we're going to go with.
Yeah.
Okay. So we also meet André Le Notre, whose job it is to build the King's Gardens. Sabine goes there for an interview where there are four other male candidates for the job, and they are all just absolutely shook that a woman is in their presence, and she really emphasizes, like, she works for herself, you know?
Immediately I'm in. This is 1682, and I'm like, you go, girl.
Yes.
You fight for that job.
She's like, I'm here for me.
Yes.
She has to provide a portfolio of sorts for garden design, and André criticizes her lack of order in her design style and dismisses her.
And André is a real person from history who really did design the landscapes and gardens for the Palace of Versailles.
However, despite his dismissal of her, he goes to see Sabine and comments on the fact that she moved one of his topiaries in his own garden when she came for the interview. He, like, watched her messing with his stuff. He admires her own home garden, references it as chaos, but she calls it her Eden, and he offers her the job at Versailles, probably to everyone's mutual surprise.
Yes. Sorry, I have to take another tangent here.
Go for it.
The Palace of Versailles, if you have not been, is amazing, and I have to say something crazy. I have a relative whose significant other works as a pastry chef at the Palace of Versailles.
That's right.
And I just
amazing.
I'm not gonna give any more details than that, but yeah, I don't want to like name drop.
Yeah, can't imagine though. Want to go?
I know. I need to go again.
This is gonna sound so stupid, but I didn't know that the Palace of Versailles was still like a functional building. I kind of thought it was like a museum of sorts. Is it? What's its purpose now?
Yes, it is like a cultural site now. So you can go and it is like a museum. Like there's tours, there's still the gardens. But this person who works as a pastry chef there, I think it's actually on the grounds, but not in the palace itself. I think it's like a restaurant or something on the outside of the grounds.
That's so cool.
Yeah, but it's beautiful.
On my list.
I'll share some pics.
Yes, please. Andre and Sabine compare plans for the gardens, and part of what they're designing is an outdoor ballroom, which seems to shock and delight Sabine. As he leaves her, she asks, "Why me?" And he says the gardens should be light enough to embrace voices other than his own. So Andre is progressive enough to get out of his own dang way.
Yeah.
Sabine falls asleep working on the designs, and she has a dream when a child yells, "Mama," she wakes up and says, "I'm coming," and then realizes there's no child. And so we're like, there's some mystery to Sabine. Who is this child? At Versailles, one of their greatest challenges, and like all of Versailles is under construction at this point, so it's not just the gardens, it's like no one lives there yet. So at Versailles, one of their greatest challenges will be sourcing water for the garden. Sabine, brilliant, has the idea to build a reservoir and recycle the water for the fountains.
What a gal. And it's just mind-boggling to think about the extravagant places that were built, like, by hand without modern tools throughout history.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. When I think about the pyramids, my brain stops working.
Oh, yeah.
But we were in Italy for our honeymoon, and, like, everything is so intricately carved and painted and, like, all by hand. Like, we went to Pompeii, and even in Pompeii, the mosaic tiling that was done. And I realized, like, mosaic even today is still pretty manual, but it's just like, what?
Yes.
I don't know.
How?
It really gets me.
Everything's so intricate.
It is. And I'm like, I don't have the patience. I really don't.
Me neither.
Like, I can't even, like, you know, they make adult coloring books.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, what a relaxing hobby and activity to decompress. No. I get, like, a third of the way through it. I'm like, why is this not done? Next. Like, I can't.
Same. I have an unfinished paint by number that I got, like, over the pandemic. Never finished it.
Please hold.
Please hold.
Let me show you.
Yes.
This paint by number, which was started circa March 2020, if you know what time that was.
It looks beautiful.
It's, Allie, it's literally 90% complete.
Yeah, I was going to say, from here it looks done. You're so close.
I did not finish. Like, why didn't I finish it? Like, only the number two is left. Why didn't I just finish it, you know?
It's so pretty. You could still finish.
I have a real problem with consistency.
Here, please hold.
Are you going to get your paint by number? We recognize we're not on YouTube and nobody can see what we're doing, but it's fine because we can. And I'll provide just a visual effect. I just unrolled a canvas scroll that has my paint by number on it. It's like a couple of deer eating on a hillside. It's very picturesque.
Sorry, I don't have AirPods, so I couldn't hear any of that.
Oh, that's okay. I was giving a visual description to our audience. Oh,
yes, great. I'm laughing at the fact that this was in reach for both of us.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yours is way less complete than mine.
Way less complete. I was like, I'm going to start with brown because it's boring. And then I got bored. And I was like, I don't want to keep using stupid brown, but I didn't move on to another color. I just stopped.
Are they flowers? Is it flowers? What is it?
I literally can't remember. And I can't tell. It's not done enough for me to tell. I think it must be some sort of abstract floral thing. That seems like something I would have chosen.
Yeah. I'm like, I want something really complicated. And then I'm like, why did I get something so complicated? My tiny brush is not tiny enough for these tiny spots. And then I can't read the number, but then I can see the number still through the paint. It's very frustrating. Anyway. Yes.
Oh man, that was
that was so funny that we both had that, like, within arm's reach.
Within arm's reach, basically, yeah.
Yeah, at this point they've been sitting in there for like 3.5 years.
3 years. That's so funny. Oh, man. Signs I need to continue purging.
We learn Andre has a wife. She looks a bit older than him. So at first, honestly, I thought it was his mom. It's not. She seems jealous of Sabine.
Old time movies.
We like start writing, and then we're like backspace, backspace, backspace. Yeah. Wife. She seems jealous of Sabine and of Andre taking interest in another woman, even professionally, which obviously seems like it was probably uncommon for that kind of relationship anyway. Mm-hmm. Work has begun in Sabine's outdoor ballroom. It's mostly just a muddy mess, but she is physically and emotionally more invested in it than anyone else. She's all in. Sabine attends an event at the Louvre. I still want to say the R. I really do. I want to say it.
Yeah, you can just say Louvre. I learned that there.
Okay. Sabine attends an event at the Louvre, and she seems out of place. A man intercepts her, takes her to a window to get some air, and he asks, "Your first time at court, madame?" She was under the impression she was there for a dinner celebrating the gardens, but it's like literally the entire court gathered, which is huge. The man is Antoine Lazoon, and he kindly gives her a tour, lets her know of some gossip, like the king's mistresses, and they re-enter the party where people stare at her because she is a commoner. Oh, this is going to answer our question from our last episode. Mm-hmm. Philippe d'Orleans?
Sounds right.
D'Orleans? Orléans? Oh, it's not going to answer it. It's adding more confusion. In our previous episode, we were trying to decide if New Orleans is New Orleans or New Orleans.
Yeah.
And we still don't know. I'm just going to call him Philippe, I think.
Yeah.
If that's okay with
call
you.
Call him Phil if you want, for all I care.
Phil. Phil. Well, Phil is played by Stanley Tucci, which is just an utter delight.
Yes.
And he interrupts Andre and Sabine talking to introduce himself and his gaggle of followers. He is gregarious and does not hold back his very humorous opinions. He's kind of like a breath of fresh air in this stuffy, aristocratic society. Andre has a private audience with the king later, who is just lounging, eating macaroons by the fire outside. Sounds like a great evening. The king asks about Andre introducing new ideas into the garden design. He's like, "It's fine, but it has to be perfect. Don't make a joke of me."
Right. Since they're eating by fire outside, what is the best fireside snack or beverage, in your opinion?
You know, I think like a spiked apple cider.
Mmm.
And, you know, I do love a s'more, but I really love just like a burnt marshmallow by the fire.
Oh, okay. Like charred all black?
Charred. Yeah. What about
That's how I like mine too. But I will say I've adjusted my method. I used to just get it on fire right away to char the outside. But I like to try and wait to char the outside because I want the inside to get a little gooier first.
Yes. Absolutely.
So I'll do a slow burn for a while and then char the outside.
And then you just shove it in the flames.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was going to say s'more also. I feel like that's an obvious answer. Beverage, I didn't have something immediately come to mind, but after considering for a while, I feel like maybe like a hot cocoa.
Mm. That is good.
Yeah.
We love the fall drinks coming into play.
Oh, we do.
It's time.
It is time. Yeah.
I'm ready, you know?
Oh, we could get on a whole tangent on fall drinks. Better not. Better not even start it.
No. Don't start. Okay. Andre's wife asks if he enjoyed his evening and remarks, "You were with that woman," and just walks away, which is a great way to have a conversation with your spouse. Construction continues. They have to set off dynamite to clear some rock, and there's a small crowd there to watch the spectacle. But when it goes off, Sabine flashes to a young girl, and she's the only person in the crowd to not step back from the blast. And Andre seems a little concerned about this and kind of gently calls her reckless.
Mm-hmm.
She inquires about Andre's wife not often accompanying him, and he is surprised and says she's very direct. And he asks if Sabine is married, and we learn that she is a widow. Andre shows her a shrine where there's these ribbons and chimes in the woods. They've been hung on a tree. And they look at each other, and there are some vibes happening in this moment. And someone chooses this moment to ride up on a horse and tell them that the queen is dead. When Andre tells his wife that the queen is dead, her first reaction is very subtle, and she's like, "Well, can he get married again?" Seems to kind of be suggesting herself for the role. And he's like, "Yeah, but you should tread carefully on this subject. And also, we're married.
Right, in case you forgot.
Yeah. Work on the outdoor ballroom continues to progress. Andre visits the work sites. Bean makes them this little lunch. They talk about the queen, and they learn that they have to chop off her head for some sort of 1600s autopsy. Ugh. And the king is in mourning, so he's kind of like withdrawn from society. When Andre starts to leave, Sabine takes his hand and then walks away. So there's just this tension between them. What is happening? Sabine continues to have flashbacks of the child, but we don't really see anything in them. She seems to have them more often when she's around carriages or loud noises. She's kind of triggered.
Side note, Kale walked by as we were watching this movie and just like pointed and laughed when he saw that it was Alan Rickman in a King Louis wig.
The wig is huge.
It's, yeah, it is.
It must have been so heavy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? My neck would hurt.
Yeah, you're so right. You have to like exercise your neck.
Yeah, you have to train for that.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot of hours a day to be in that heavy wig.
So true.
King Louis goes to a fruit orchard for some privacy, taking off his wig and coat. Sabine arrives to exchange some plants for shrubs, but she mistakes him for the king's gardener without his wig, and also she's, like, never actually seen him before, so she doesn't know who he is. He lets her believe this and says she's just the company he needs. It suddenly clicks for her. She figures out that he's the king, but he asks if they can ignore that she knows and continue on as before. And they do, sort of feigning that they're equals. She tells him about what she's been working on, and they just have this, like, nice chat, really.
Honestly, so admirable that she can just talk to him so casually after she figures out who he is.
Right.
Like, that would be so intimidating.
Especially at that time where, like, royalty was everything.
Oh, yeah.
Crazy.
Like, I would even still get nervous, like, if I get into the elevator and the CEO of my company is there. Like,
yeah.
I'll still be a little nervous, you know? She was so casual.
Yeah. She was like, yeah, let's talk about pears. What do you want to hear? What do you want to learn about? I'll tell you about this tree.
Yeah.
The king helps her carry the flowers in and accompanies her as she selects shrubs for his garden. They eat pears together, and he shares some thoughts on his wife's death and life and confides in her about the small journal that his wife had kept with everyday thoughts in it. Just like kind of an inside peek at their relationship. The king says he'd like to marry again, but someone he chooses instead of the state. He has someone in mind that he enjoys talking to, but politically it would be difficult. Sabine asks if anyone even has to know. Could it just be private versus a spectacle like his first wedding? When the king asks if there's anyone she loves, she says it's private, which is like kind of bold to say to the king who just effectively poured his heart out.
Seriously.
He tells her to go for it, in so many words, and that it's time for both of them to do so. Like, essentially, like, we deserve happiness. Andre is summoned to Fontainebleau.
I love it.
Which is a country estate. His wife inquires about Sabine, asking if there's anything she should know, and insists to keep it separate for sake of not embarrassing her. But Andre essentially alludes to the fact that his wife is unfaithful to him, and that she chose this life for them. Like, they have an agreement, essentially, but she's not too happy now that the tables have turned, and he's kind of taking advantage of their open marriage.
Right. Like, she's had multiple affairs, we learn.
Yeah. Back at the worksite, Andre's wife goes to see Sabine and tells her that she's not his first or only diversion, essentially saying there's nothing special about her. She even, total power play move, caresses Sabine's cheek like she pities her. And I was like, that was brutal.
The audacity.
Honestly.
Also, nothing has happened between them yet.
No, yet. Nothing, though. And, like, were affairs just rampant in these times because people couldn't or didn't marry for love? Like, it seems like no one was actually together.
I agree. It seems like just that was just, like, part of the culture.
Yeah. Wild.
So crazy.
Andre's wife's lover suggests messing with the reservoir system and flooding the grounds. She's like, yes, do it. And not only that, but rip apart the tiered structure, like, pretty much all the construction that's been done.
I do not understand this. Like, literally, she has her lover do this.
Yes.
Out of jealousy. And ultimately, it's going to reflect poorly on her husband, which will hurt her social standing. So, seems like it would be a bad idea for her. Like, I get she wants to, like, get revenge, but it'll be hurting her, too.
Right. Sabine and her crew run to the site to try to fix or protect everything. Sabine is immediately suspicious. She knows that someone has messed with the water system. And there's this, like, well kind of system that's been dug. And she enters it. She's trying to stop this flooding. She falls into the depths of a well.
It's like rushing water.
Yeah, I'd be like, well, the gardens are done. I don't know. I'm not going in there.
That would be like when you stopped the paint by number. Like, nope, that's it.
Yeah. Well, 90% is far enough.
Yeah.
She does manage to shut the door of the well thing, which I made a note. We were going to look up terminology, and then we didn't.
Seems like it was kind of like a dam from the river to their reservoir that was rushing in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And causing it to flood. So she had to try and close it.
Sure. Yeah. Andre helps her out. He tells her it can be fixed. She's not to blame. She then says she's not used to all this, implying maybe their unspoken feelings, and asks if he's honest. He says he's not been honest since he saw her in this garden, that her heart beats powerfully and his just ticks. She says if he's hungry, she'll feed him. Is this a euphemism? What's happening? Are we in a romance novel? And that if she's mad, he must tell her. Like, am I just imagining this between us? They very quietly and casually proceed indoors. And she kind of silently cries before they kiss, saying it's from happiness. But ultimately, she doesn't go through anything with him and leaves, returning to the worksite to continue cleaning up. She is sleeping in the work cabin when she overhears the king outside with other workers and Andre reviewing the progress. The king asks if they trust Sabine's plans and if it's worthy of, quote, us. And every single one of the men speak up in favor of Sabine's design and vision, including Andre, even though the king only sees mud right now.
Ugh, how validating. And she overheard all of this. It's not like they only said this because they knew she was there.
Right.
Ugh, I love it.
Especially because they were all so against her being involved in this at the beginning.
Right. She's fighting an uphill battle. It's the 1600s and she's a working woman. Like,
right.
Ugh, good for her.
As Andre leaves the site, he notices a glove in the mud and recognizes it as his wife's. Dun, dun, dun.
Right.
Sabine is at Fontainebleau. Lejeune escorts her downstairs, and he said her nobody status is actually making her a somebody because people are curious about, like, how is she rising these ranks? Mm-hmm. Who is she? She's just a gardener. He introduces her to a group of women at Fontainebleau and then just abandons her, which is the best way to make friends. We learn that her daughter died when she was 6 years old, and the women are all very blunt and ask very personal questions. Sabine's clearly still very sad about this. It's hard for her to talk about, but she does confide in them. And despite being a different status from them, they are ultimately kind to her. She's kind of presented to the king for the first time, quote unquote. She offers him a rose, and they have this little inside joke from the garden, and he comments on how light it is and not overblown, and there's, like, some metaphors potentially on the other women in the room, and everyone seems shocked by their exchange because they're just kind of quipping back and forth.
Right, and they don't know about how they met, like, at that orchard.
Right. He asks her how to care for the rose, and she says, "Patience, care, and a little warmth from the sun are our best chance." He thanks her and invites her to walk with him so she can tell him of the progress in the garden. Andre compliments Sabine's bravery, and then we get an intimate love scene between them, just like that.
Just like that. I feel like Kate Winslet's facials in this love scene were so intimate. I had to look away. I was like, I can't look you in the eyes right now, Kate Winslet.
Yeah. Avoid eye contact because it's a personal moment.
It was so personal. I felt like I was I felt like I was intruding.
Yeah, I felt like I opened the door and I needed to shut it.
Yes.
Andre wakes up alone. Sabine flashes back to her husband, saying he's going away for the day and taking their daughter, Marie Claire. He tells her that he's had an affair and that it's normal in circumstances like this. Her father puts Marie Claire into the carriage and they drive off. And as they're leaving, Sabine notices the wheel on the carriage is loose, but the hand says that her husband said it would be fine for their journey to the town where his mistress lives. Sabine tries to stop the carriage, but it veers and the wheel breaks and falls down the side of a hill, and her husband and daughter are both killed. In real time, Sabine is screaming and crying. Andre finds her and convinces her that it's not her fault, even though she's convinced that her daughter is dead because of her. He asks what would help her, and she just says, if you help me, like essentially if you're here for me. They talk about what will happen to Andre's wife. He says she'll live her own life now, and now Andre and Sabine have each other. And that was just like a real fast resolution of this problem, honestly.
He's like, I'm over her.
Yeah, well, we're done. We flash forward to the opening of the gardens. The king himself escorts Sabine in her outdoor ballroom. It is gorgeous. They turn on the fountains. They work.
Oh.
Wow, physics. The king smiles and the crowd applauds. There's this hidden orchestra playing music, and the king and Sabine have the first dance in this outdoor ballroom. It is so beautiful. She looks so proud. Oh my God.
We're so happy.
And the movie ends with a zoom out of people dancing around the king in the garden.
Yes.
And it really kills me because it's clearly a model. And I'm like, you could have done better to end this movie.
That's so fair.
That's the end.
Oh.
Thoughts?
I really liked it. And I found that it was unique because sometimes period pieces all feel the same. And this did have some elements of period pieces that I think we see a lot, like recurring affairs and things like that. But I thought this was unique because of her position being like a working woman in, I don't know, I liked that about it.
Yeah, there's some female empowerment in it.
Yeah.
That we don't get as often.
Right.
In a movie like this.
Also the cast, strong cast.
Cast is amazing. Alan Rickman, Stanley Tucci, just love him.
Yeah.
This was also directed by Alan Rickman, who also co-wrote the screenplay. So Alan Rickman was very involved in this movie.
And he's like, yeah, and I'm going to play the king, too.
Yeah, why not? Put me in coach. Yeah. Oh, the coach is me? Okay.
Also, Kate Winslet's daughter, Mia, plays Helene in this, who I think is one of the children at the beginning.
Yeah, must be. I wonder if she's in anything else. I mean, I know she's in I Am Ruth, obviously.
Right.
But I wonder if she's been in other stuff with Kate.
I don't remember seeing her in other stuff with Kate, but I do remember the story of how, you know, she has a different last name than Kate Winslet. She mm-hmm. is Mia. I almost said
Thermopolis.
Thermopolis.
For the Princess Diaries. It's actually, I think it's close to that, actually.
It's Thrapleton, I think.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Mia Thrapleton, but I literally almost just said Mia Thermopolis.
Princess of Genovia.
Mia Thrapleton. And that she purposely did not tell people when she was going into an audition that she was Kate Winslet's daughter. So I think she's had other acting gigs, but I don't know about any besides this and I Am Ruth with Kate.
Yeah. I don't like when movies have two names. And I feel like they do that more often when it's released in different countries. But I just wonder why it's necessary or what the benefit is. Like, is it just more culturally enticing based on where it's released? I don't.
Right. Or really is there some, like, could they not get the rights to that name? Or, like, is it,
right.
You know what I mean? Something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I like the name The King's Garden better than A Little Chaos. I felt like A Little Chaos is, like, briefly mentioned at the beginning because Andre's like, your design is chaotic. And that was kind of the end of it, you know?
Yeah, The King's Garden is, like, very straightforward.
Yeah. What else did you like or dislike?
I really liked the melancholy music.
Yes.
Yeah. There's also this, like, guitar plucking in the background occasionally that I thought was a unique take on how to do music in a movie, so I liked it.
Just really sets the mood.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that French people are annoyed that their accents just get chucked out the window for British accents in every movie? Like, they're in France, presumably speaking French with French names.
Right, but they're all in this movie speaking with British accents.
Literally 100% of them.
Yes.
Like,
what? You're so
right.
Do you
think French people watch this and they're like, are you, again, seriously?
Yeah. Like, are you kidding me? I will say probably why we didn't rate it a lot higher is, I think, kind of a common theme with some period pieces is that there's, like, long periods of time in the movie with not a lot of action, just a lot of, like, contemplating life and stuff like that. And there is some of that in this movie. There are some characters and some scenes that don't really add a lot to moving the plot. So at times it could feel slow or like that you're getting some unnecessary information.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as far as like a fleshed out plot, it could be better in that way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And also kind of interesting, I mean, we're going to talk about Kate's character in a minute. But in real life, Andre began work at Versailles in 1661. So he was almost 70 years old by 1682 when this movie starts. And in movie, he's definitely not 70.
Right.
He's so like, true. He's like probably in his 30s or 40s.
Right, right.
So, you know, this was loosely based on historical accuracy.
Right. yeah, overall, I would say, though, we liked it. 7 out of 10, solid score.
Yeah.
So for Kate's character, Sabine, we gave her an 8.25 out of 10. She is really likable. We already talked about this. She's a strong lady working for herself in the 1600s. Don't need no man. Totally wish this was a real character, by the way. Like, Andre's character is real. But I'm like, oh, I wish Sabine was real.
I know. Yeah, the fact that she's not is kind of disappointing. Like, I really wish that she was a real person in history.
I know. I'm like, well, I guess, yeah, it probably wasn't really like that in the 1600s.
Yeah. I'm sure there's an interview, but, like, what was the inspiration for Alan Rickman and his co-writer or co-writers of, like, let's go add a female garden designer to the Palace of Versailles?
Yeah.
Like, you know.
How'd they come up with that? Right.
Yeah. But I love her confidence in this movie. I feel like that is just one of her strongest traits. She's so direct. She's not afraid of being thought improper or dancing around subjects. Like, even when she's in the garden with the king and she's like, oh, you're the king. And he's like, let's pretend I'm not. And she's like, okay.
Right. Yeah, her confidence is really, like, unmatched.
Yeah. I feel like she really has, like, a what have I got to lose attitude in this movie. Where she's like, I've worked really hard and I've already lost so much. Like, I can't possibly lose more. So why would I not try, you know?
So true. Love it. She also seems to be an introvert. Like, you can tell she's exhausted by social endeavors. She prefers to be in nature, like working in the garden, designing something, but it's like balanced by her grit and charm when she has to put it on. And it's just interesting to see kind of that change in her character when she has to like go through these, you know, social situations and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just loved it. I love that she like gets in, she's doing the manual labor with all these male workers.
Yes.
She's in a freaking corset.
Are you kidding me?
She's like, move aside.
I love it.
Yeah, it's just very empowering.
Yeah.
So for Kate's acting, we gave her an 8 out of 10. Again, a pretty strong score. And, you know, just something about Kate Winslet's face looks like she was born in the 1600s to 1700s. Why does her face work so perfectly for period pieces? She looks amazing in the costumes. I'm like, your little wispy ringlets by your face just work naturally. You don't look like you look like an American Girl doll. I love it.
Totally. I also love the way she really infuses life into this character from the 1600s. I think we always think about people from history or they're often presented as being like very buttoned up and very formal, like times were different then. But she really brings a lot of personality to her character. And she shows that like people are still people. She was capable of being frustrated and overwhelmed and nervous and, you know, things like that, which I think she humanizes a character. And sometimes in period pieces, I think it's hard to get that.
Agree. Yeah. And as far as Kate's kind of like physicality and chemistry in this movie, she had this kind of slight air of constant concern.
Mm-hmm.
And it was carried very much in her face and in her brow. Yes. And it seems dumb to say, but her furrowed brow acting, if I had to specify, was very good in this movie.
Yes, so true.
It like deepened when she was thinking or confused. And I feel like she just held it on her face, like, the whole time.
Yes. So true. I also feel like her best on-screen chemistry, so although she had a romantic connection with Andre, I think her best on-screen chemistry was with Alan Rickman.
Mm-hmm.
And they had such a bond and intensity on screen together. And it was so clearly not romantic. Like, it was so clearly they just created this bond by being in this orchard together. And I really loved seeing that. I don't know, unique to see a connection that's non-romantic. And I thought the chemistry between them in that setting was so good.
Yeah. I guess I'm circling back now to the plot. One thing that kind of bothered me was when they're in the orchard and he's like, I want to marry again, but someone I pick. And there's someone I enjoy talking to, but it would be complicated. You know, they have no status, whatever. I was like, is he talking about her? Like, he's known her for, you know, 30 seconds. And he's like, well, this is a meet cute and we should get married. Or because there's never any mention of any other additional marriage or another, like, woman for
That's
him.
True.
So I thought that was kind of weird. But
yeah, that
anyway,
is weird. I didn't take it as her, but I see your point.
I agree. Their chemistry was great.
Yeah.
And just throughout, like, I feel like sometimes we say with her acting, like, oh, it didn't require a lot of her. And I didn't think that her acting in this movie was overly dramatic other than when she wakes from the daydream or the nightmare or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's very controlled. It's not, yeah. I didn't read it as like, oh, this was like a throwaway easy payday. Obviously, I don't think any movie is, but
right.
It just seemed like there was intense effort behind this and it just like came off as the character. It was just very well done.
Yes. And she portrayed a lot of emotion, even if it was not a dramatic display of that emotion.
Mm-hmm.
She portrayed a lot of nuanced emotion, I think.
Agreed.
So for our bonus category this season, it's how feisty the character was. And we had to give her a 1.5 out of 2 here. So pretty strong. Running your own business in the 1600s as a woman makes her bold and feisty in general, I think.
Yeah.
And she's also so like blunt and kind of brash in her remarks. She doesn't really care if people like her or not. She's just very like, well, here I am, take it or leave it. And I think especially in that time, that was feisty.
Yeah. And I like that it still came off genuine.
Yeah.
Like she wasn't like a jerk for it.
Right. She wasn't like unkind or anything. Yeah.
Yeah. Like speaking up in court like that to the king.
Yeah.
Like,
are you kidding?
Feisty.
Yeah. Love it.
And then for our Would You Watch Again score, surprisingly, we gave this a 1 out of 5. I really liked watching this a lot. I would recommend it as a watch, but I wouldn't rewatch it. I think because of what you said earlier, like some of these period pieces, it's just so contemplative and kind of slow where I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Right. And like, I got it. I got to see it once. It's not like I need to keep rewatching it to like get some emotional reaction from myself or something or
right,
to learn
right.
more or something.
Yeah.
So to review, before we move on to our next movie, for A Little Chaos, we gave the plot a 7 out of 10, Kate's character, Sabine, an 8.25 out of 10, her acting an 8 out of 10, a feisty score of 1.5 out of 2, and a Would You Watch Again score of a 1 out of 5, bringing this to a total of 25.75 out of 37 points, meaning that this is ranked number 13. So it is very high up there.
It is. Definitely worth it.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to our next period piece movie, one of many of Kate's. Now we're moving into the 1700s. This is called Quills. It was released in 2000, and Kate plays a character named Madeline or Maddie, and you can rent this on Amazon. In this movie, the Marquis de Sade, oh, it's another French movie.
That sounded right when you said it, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the Marquis de Sade, is desperate to write within the insane asylum, and he charms both the laundress and the priest to get his story out no matter the price he has to pay. We probably do need a trigger warning because this movie has some heavy and mature content, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not open to that or you have little folks with you, you might want to skip to the end of this episode to hear how it ranks. But otherwise, if you want to watch this, pause, go watch. From here on out, there will be spoilers. I think this is also kind of worth the watch. I was going back through the plot and I was like, oh yeah, this is action-packed.
Right.
There's a lot happening here.
Right. Agreed.
Yeah.
I'm with you. All right, so let's jump into the plot. We gave the plot of Quills a 7.75 out of 10. We're in Paris again, but it's 1794. The incarcerated Marquis de Sade pens the story of Mademoiselle Renard, a woman with unusual sexual proclivities who's met her match for pain-seeking and an executioner. So we're really just jumping right in here without adult content. She is publicly beheaded. Years later, in an insane asylum, we see Maddie, played by Kate. She's going from door to door collecting linens. She works there. From one room, she secretly collects some pages, and the man inside, the Marquis, instructs her to hurry.
And this little peek we get in there, this is a luxe prison cell.
Yeah.
If I had to describe one.
Agreed, especially for the 1700s.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
As she's leaving the grounds, Joaquin Phoenix, a priest, steps in when she's blocked by one of the patients. She delivers the papers to a man on a horse through a gate. They whisper about selling manuscripts secretly. So we're learning here that Kate's character, Maddie, is helping the Marquis get his manuscripts out to the public. In the streets, we see Justine, which is the name of the book, being distributed. It's kind of an erotic story. Men are excitedly and like a ghastly reading it aloud to each other everywhere from the street to in the king's quarters. It's like taken the town by storm.
Mm-hmm.
The king demands all copies be collected and burned and for the author to be shot. His advisors tell him if he goes too hard on this, he will not be remembered well. They recommend using an alternative method to get the point across, essentially torture, administered by Dr. Royal Collard, played by none other than Michael Caine.
Also, it's Napoleon, and they show his little legs swinging from the throne, which I thought was a hilarious yes, detail to add.
So funny. Joaquin Phoenix's character, the priest, his name is Colmier?
Colmier is what I would go with.
Yeah. Colmier is teaching Maddie how to read and write. There's definitely some chemistry between them, but alas, he is a priest.
Yeah. He touches her hand, and there are sparks.
There are sparks.
Something's happening.
Maddie practices reading with the book Justine around others, and they're shocked by the content, but she seems to be fine with it. She defends the Marquis as they gossip about what he's in for. When Maddie delivers linens the next day, the Marquis asks for a proper visit and asks her to come into the room. She is a little disturbed, maybe curious, about some of the phallic art in the room, and she gives him money from the sale of the book and brushes off his advances, which is why he's invited her in. He implies he's writing about her, a laundress, and she's intrigued by this and interested in the erotic story, and he says it'll cost her a kiss per page that he lets her see.
Blech.
She gives him a few kisses on the cheek and gets a few pages from him, but then he aggressively kisses her. Seriously?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was like, is this flirting in the 1700s? And then I was like, oh, never mind. It's assault.
Yep. Got too aggressive. Nope.
Not flirting.
Colmier notices the Marquis's door is ajar. He comes in just after Maddie has had enough and slaps the Marquis across the face. Maddie tells him he got there just in the nick of time, as he thought she was a character in one of his writings. And Colmier, rather than protecting her, comments that the next time she gets the urge to visit the Marquis, she should go to confession instead.
Blaming women. What Seriously. Does he think she's doing? Like, clearly she's upset.
Right. Ugh. Mm. So Colmier admonishes the Marquis for entertaining visitors in his quarters and implies that Maddie is naive and vulnerable. Colmier seems to be into art therapy and advises him to write it down instead of act on it.
I love he also has patients painting. At one point we see him ask an arsonist if painting fires was better than setting them. Like, it feels like kind of progressive for this time period yeah. where he's like, get it out through the arts, you know?
Right, right. Colmier directs the choir while Maddie watches.
Okay, we left this note in here because I'm like, does nobody else work here? This man has 12 jobs. He's like Oscar Nunez in The Proposal, who like does every job in the town. I'm like, I'm like expecting to see him like serving up dinner too, like with a little hairnet on.
Yeah, you're the priest. You're the art therapy guy. You're
the choir director.
Protecting the workers. Oh, yeah, you're so right.
Oh, so funny.
Dr. Collard arrives. Remember, this is Michael Caine. He says he's there to oversee Colmier, but really it's because of the king's interest in the Marquis. Colmier says Marquis has made great progress here. He even runs their theater. Okay.
Love it.
The Marquis is in this insane asylum rather than a prison because of his wife. She wanted him deemed insane instead of being a convicted criminal, obviously. I feel like that's, I don't know, maybe it's not obvious.
I think it was because she wanted, it was a social standing thing, yeah. and their wealth, she was like, you're not going to bring me down.
Right, right. Colmier says the Marquis's writing is necessary for his treatment and recovery, but agrees that the work should not be published. So he is shocked when the doctor shows him the published book, Justine. He assures Dr. Collard that it won't happen again. Colmier tells Maddie about how the Marquis has been slipping his manuscripts to a publisher. Maddie has to act surprised, obviously, since she's the one who's been in on it. And Colmier confronts the Marquis and shows him the book. He says it's a disappointment, and rather than honing in on the content, he also criticizes the plot and the characters. Colmier warns him that one more trick like this and he'll have to take away his liberties, and reveals that their institution is at risk of being shut down.
I love it. The Marquis goes, yes, it is a disappointment. The text is too small and the paper is cheap.
Like, it's not good enough.
Yeah.
Dr. Collard goes to a convent to collect a girl who is to be his wife, Simone, even though she's clearly still a teenager.
And she's, like, very poor. This is not a good situation for anyone.
And again, I'm like, is this just what the 1700s were like? Ooh. Not ideal.
Dr. Collard's not meeting a mate naturally through his torture practice.
Imagine that. They're given a bit of a dilapidated estate to live on near the asylum, but it needs a lot of repairs. Simone seems shocked at the size of the home. She's clearly not used to it. And as the doctor talks about repairs needed, he insists that she should be caged and says to put a lock on the outside of her door and iron gates over her window. Excuse me?
What?
And again, trigger warning here. You might want to fast forward. We also see that he assaults her at night, and it is awful.
I feel especially offended that this is Michael Caine.
So true.
I'm like, how could you be so creepy and terrible? You are supposed to be a Miss Congeniality fashion consultant, Michael Caine. What has happened to you?
What has happened? It's so true.
Oh, it's so disappointing.
The townspeople gossip about the doctor and his new wife, insisting that she's too young and that he's too old. So it's clearly not that accepted, even in the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
They say she was supposed to be a nun, etc. And the gossip makes its way to Maddie, who tells the Marquis. He says it's the making of a great story. He's inspired. At the insane asylum, the residents are preparing for a theater performance with Dr. Collard in attendance. The Marquis decides to change their performance and premiere a new play in honor of Dr. Collard and his bride. Does this not suddenly remind you of Hamlet?
Oh my God, it totally does.
Changing the play to reflect something that someone in the audience is going through. What?
Like nefarious? Yeah. Yes. Wow. We learned something from Shakespeare.
Yeah, we did. Look at us go. Maybe look at us. Inspired by Hamlet.
Oh my God, we took something away from a Shakespeare plot. I love it.
Colmier pulls out his rosary when he hears this, which is kind of a funny little thing.
It's like, Lord help me.
Yeah. The play seems to be a pretty accurate representation of what has happened to the Collards, and it's pretty crude. The doctor makes his wife leave, even though she doesn't want to, and Colmier also leaves, clearly embarrassed. The rest of the crowd laughs and is thoroughly entertained. Maddie's kind of like a stage manager during this, giving everyone their cues and wrangling the actors. And while everyone is out on the stage, the man who had cornered her earlier in the movie attacks her while he's alone. She fights back with an iron, hits him in the face with it, and Colmier comforts her and seems to blame the Marquis for inspiring this behavior in another patient. Colmier inquires of the doctor if the play's content was fiction. Kind of seems like Colmier is hoping or wishing that it's fiction,
mm-hmm.
and the doctor assures him that it is. He tells him he needs to shut down the theater and get his place in order, or he'll report back to the king that the inmates are running the asylum. Colmier tells the Marquis to read more instead of write, and he confiscates the Marquis's quills because he can't be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
At the doctor's new house, the workers tell him that his wife's preferences for the remodel are above budget, but the doctor doesn't care and says to just give her what she wants.
Also, the architect seems to be crushing on the wife. They're more appropriately aged for each other. And I'm here for it. I'm like, yes.
Yes, me too. The Marquis's wife comes to the doctor's house to talk to him. The doctor tells her he could help, but it'll cost her. He tells her to use the funds from the Marquis's books to pay for his continued treatment. At the institution, the Marquis resorts to using a chicken bone and his wine from dinner to write on his sheets because all of his materials have been taken from him.
Credit for ingenuity.
Yeah. He passes the sheet to Maddie in the morning, who transcribes it. Her blind mother insists she read it to her, despite Maddie's warnings that it's not to her taste. But turns out her mom's, like, into it.
Her mom's like, that's too terrible. Well, go on.
It is really funny to see, like, the public's reaction to the content.
Yes. Yeah, they're like, oh my gosh, wait, no. Keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
What comes next?
The wine sheets dye other sheets, like in the wash, which alerts the doctor, who calls Maddie out for being involved in this. The Marquis's room is then essentially stripped of anything he could possibly write with or on, which is basically everything in the room. So it becomes very bare. The Marquis, desperate to write, breaks a mirror in his room and cuts his finger. Maddie delivers the Marquis his breakfast and sees his cut-up fingers. He tells her he's been tortured and begs her to open the door, which she does. He sneaks out the door as another worker chastises Maddie for, quote, conspiring with the devil. The Marquis then causes chaos with the other residents. The doctor barges in, and they finally get him back to his room. Maddie is whipped publicly for aiding him. Her colleague snitched on her, by the way.
Ugh.
Colmier steps in, insists it stops, and frees her, putting himself in her place, ready to receive her whippings. The doctor mocks him for martyring himself for a chambermaid instead of God and does not whip him. Just like, ugh, all around here, you know?
Yeah.
Colmier regrets teaching Maddie to read if this was what she was going to do.
He's like, I thought we were going to read the Bible together.
Right. Like, come on. But she says the Marquis's writing transports her to another life. Colmier resolves to send her away. At their house that's being remodeled, the doctor's wife flirts with that architect who's, like we said, near her age, and asks if he's into books, giving him a copy of her secret copy, Justine. I'm like, that's a bold move.
Mm-hmm.
He suggests she should learn from experience, and she quips back that it requires a teacher. Things have escalated quickly here.
Bold. Forward.
Right? That night, Maddie sneaks out of her room and goes to visit Colmier. She confesses that she doesn't want to be sent away because she has feelings for him. He tells her she must not voice these feelings. They kiss passionately, but then stops themselves as they realize what they've done. When he goes to chase after her, of course, the colleague who snitched on her before is in the hall and looks at him like, suspects what's going on.
Yeah.
The doctor's wife and the architect's passion or love has escalated quickly, and they have decided to run away together, leaving the doctor a note telling them what they've done. The doctor generally is just not happy. Things are not going well for him. He has resolved to waterboarding the Marquis to break him of his perverse writing habits and punish him. Maddie speaks to him through the door and asks for one last story before she's sent away. After hearing screams of other residents, he seems inspired and resolves to tell her one more story by passing it along through the inmates verbally.
I feel like we all know games of telephone don't go well. So.
Oh, right, right. Their rooms are next to each other and they're like repeating lines of this story through little openings from one room to another, you know?
Yeah. And she's like at the end of it.
Right. As the story makes its way to Maddie, she excitedly starts to transcribe it onto paper. The Marquis is annoyed that they're not getting all the words exactly correct, but wonders aloud, like, maybe they'll even improve it. Like, getting some crowdsourcing here, you know?
Yeah.
The residents are all getting very excited by the story. One even setting fire to his bed after part of the story is about a fire.
I get that they have no electricity, so there's not much to be done here. But I just feel like open flames in this environment is a poor decision.
Right. Like, could you not keep them out of arm's reach outside of a door or, you know, something?
Mm-hmm.
A window, perhaps? I don't know.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. In trying to put out the fire, the resident who sets it starts spreading it. And amidst the chaos, the same resident who attacked Maddie before corners her again. The other residents hear her screaming, but they can't get to her or help her. They all scream her name, but they're locked in their rooms. But the doctor does hear and also does nothing. Colmier then hears as well. He rushes to find her, and the whole place has gone into total chaos. The resident is threatening Maddie with a pair of scissors, and all the residents have seemed to just go off the deep end.
Mm-hmm.
They've been inspired by the crude writings, and these sexual deviations abound. Colmier finds the transcription with, "She screamed, so he had to cut out her tongue, covered in blood." They find her in the washing vat, which is filled with blood and also chemicals, I think, because Maddie said earlier that's what caused her mother's blindness. And Colmier is just distraught.
She's dead, if it's not clear, I guess.
Oh, yeah, if it's not clear.
She's in the vat, dead.
Yes.
Okay.
Filled with rage and guilt, Colmier confronts the Marquis, blaming him for Maddie's death. The Marquis, filled with grief, tells him to bury her somewhere with honor at his expense. Colmier has the Marquis's tongue cut out as punishment for what happened to Maddie. He's just filled with guilt still and gives himself lashings. He then delivers the Marquis's tongue in a glass jar to the doctor. Colmier believes this was the right thing to do, but says he never expects to sleep again. Ugh. Colmier goes to see Maddie's body, which, of course, because she's dead, is naked under a sheet, and he rubs his face on her and kisses her. She opens her eyes, strokes his face, and kisses him. And we're like, he's imagining this, right?
We're like, wait, what?
And then they do it in her funeral bed.
But she's dead.
But she's dead. Yeah. You know, we have seen Kate Winslet's boobs in a lot of movies, but this, I think, is the first time we've seen dead boobs.
I think it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Colmier comes to. This has all been a dream. He's asleep on his bed.
Thank God.
Right. Just to find that the Marquis used his own blood to write a manifesto or a final story on the walls, basically like cutting himself using his own blood. Colmier is upset that he couldn't save his soul, so he prays for him. He asks the Marquis to kiss the cross after he prays, but the Marquis eats it and dies from choking on it.
Like, what is happening at this point? I'm like, my mouth is just dropped open. I'm like, this plot is absolutely out of hand. Like,
he eats the cross, put me over the edge, and then he chokes on it, like, puts me even more over the edge.
This might take the cake of the weirdest movie we've seen. Like, 100%. Kate's been in a lot of weird movies, but this one just escalates.
Oh, yeah.
Past what I thought was possible. I'm like, well, it's not going to get weirder. And then it gets weirder.
Right. Oh, yeah. Then the last bit of this is just like beyond.
Yeah. But I'm engrossed, you know? Well, I'm still watching.
Right. Like, I was going to say I'm into it. That sounds too weird. But I'm into the movie.
Yeah. I'm engaged.
Okay. 1 year passes. The new priest comes to his post at the asylum. The doctor has created a printing press that the residents run, and they are actually, ironically, printing the Marquis's work because it's in such high demand since his death. The doctor and the snitch flirt with each other. Ugh.
They deserve each other, honestly.
Yeah. The doctor brings the new priest to see Colmier, who is now a patient. Colmier begs his successor to bring him a quill and ink and parchment so he can write down his story.
Very full circle, ironic with how the Marquis had begged for writing materials. It's just right? Come around.
Right. And in through the little linen door, Maddie's mother provides Colmier what he needs to write. She tells him he owes it to Maddie to use it well.
Yeah, Mom.
Right? Like stepping in for her daughter and now she's the one sneaking in things. It's all full circle.
Mm-hmm.
His writing is narrated by the Marquis, saying he's writing through Colmier now.
Dun, dun, dun.
Right? And that's the end of the movie.
That's the end of the movie.
It's so weird in a way that I really liked. And I don't often go for just, like, weird movies.
Yeah, I think it's because they started it with a good foundation, and then they were like, well, buckle up.
Yes. Yes, I think so too.
We're taking this where you did not expect.
Right.
And it landed well for most viewers. 75% critic score, 83% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, this was a surprising one.
Yes. And based on the award-winning 1995 play by Doug Wright, who was also the screenwriter for the movie. So this kind of had a foundation in the theater.
I could totally see this being a play.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Also, strong cast. We mentioned Joaquin Phoenix, Michael Caine. They overlap with our other girl crushes. But also, the Marquis is played by the guy who plays Captain Barbossa in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Wow, I've not seen those movies in a long time.
Oh, so good.
Quills received 3 Oscar nominations for Best Actor. Jeffrey Rush, who Allie just mentioned, played Captain Barbossa, played the Marquis. Art direction and costume design. And it was also nominated by the Hollywood Foreign Press, organizers of the Golden Globes, for Best Actor in a Drama, also for Jeffrey Rush, and Best Screenplay for Douglas Wright. And the National Board of Review selected Quills as its best film of 2000. So, received a lot of awards and recognition.
Yes. It's such an intriguing plot. Nothing really goes well for anyone in this movie. It takes on some unusual topics for a period piece. The plot was, like, simple.
Mm-hmm.
But insane, you know?
Yeah, I appreciated that it was straightforward enough. I feel like period pieces often just have too many characters, like, and it gets confusing, and there's all these, like, side things going on. And I felt like this had the Marquis, and then it had Dr. Collard. And, like, right. Those were the two plots of the movie, and...
And Colmier.
Yeah, but, you know, he's kind of part with the Marquis. And I really liked there was these moments of humor. Like, there were some, like...
Oh, yeah.
Funny jokes in this movie that really counter the heavy material, because otherwise it's a dark movie. Yeah. Like, there's some difficult content in this. It is hard to watch sometimes, but I thought they balanced it pretty well.
Yeah. I wrote in this, I was like, I'm having a hard time saying I liked it, if that makes sense. Like, I was intrigued by it. I enjoyed watching it, but it feels wrong to say I liked it. I think it's because of that content being so, like, off-putting almost.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're not, like, giving your stamp of approval to
anything. Right.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's not like you're like, oh, yeah, this is my kind of movie.
Right.
But, yeah, it was just so weird. Yeah. It was so weird.
So weird.
I was really not liking the side plot of the creepy resident who wants to continuously assault Maddie throughout the movie. I was like, this is unnecessary. Like, this is just piling on. But then he kills her. So I was like, never mind. That was important.
True.
That was an important backstory. So I take it back.
True. Also, it was like, I feel like one of the, I don't know if it would be themes of the movie or whatever, was the debate of whether the Marquis's writings inspired sexual deviancy in others. Like, it, you know, people thought it was bad for the community. Other people enjoyed the content. So I feel like that sort of added to that debate.
Yeah.
But overall, just, I mean, yeah, what a movie.
What a movie. That's a great description.
Yeah.
So for Kate's character of Maddie.
Side note, Maddie, just like such a casual nickname for the 1700s, I feel like.
Yeah, agree. Very hip.
Yeah.
So for Kate's character, Maddie, we gave her a 6.5 out of 10. She is naive. She has this weird affinity for the Marquis. Right. He's very creepy. She knows he takes things too far, and she doesn't like that, but she doesn't distance herself from him at all. She keeps going back for it, and, you know, I'm not victim blaming, but
right,
I'm like,
right. He's
locked in a room, and you keep going back, so
right. You're
in control.
Yeah. Her desire to get this content, like, overrides her fear or her dislike of the interactions that she has with him, maybe. But it's in it is in a way that's naive.
And I can appreciate that she was just trying to live her life, you know? She didn't want to be put in a box because of her gender or her interests. But I thought she was pretty careless about what she was doing and how she was doing it, especially when there were signs that things were starting to escalate in a pretty terrible way.
Yeah, it's like she was clueless.
Yeah, whereas like, okay, this is not just quirky, it's like dangerous at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you're contributing to this bad stuff for society, and that was starting to become clear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We also don't really get to know that much about her, and she doesn't really grow and develop in a way that would allow us to, like, give her a lot of good character points.
Yeah. One thing I do love about her is that she's around what society would deem as, like, bottom of the barrel people, right? Like, she's working in an insane asylum, and she's undeterred by it. Like, she loves these guys. I think they're all men. And others would be scared, and she clearly should have had a little more caution, but she just treats them like people. You know, like,
I love
the theater scene when she's behind and she's, like, stage managing. She's, like, so excited for all of
them.
Right, and, like, encouraging them. And it's just so sweet.
Yes.
I loved that.
Overall, she's very likable. We just had to knock it down some for the lack of growth and her naivety, I think.
Yeah.
So for Kate's acting in this, we gave her a 7 out of 10. I think overall it was a solid showing. Screenwriter Doug Wright called Kate the, quote, patron saint of the movie for being the first big name to back it, expressing interest as early as April of 1999. So he really appreciated, you know, her willingness to be involved.
Mm-hmm. I love when she reads Justine aloud to her mom and to the other people who work in the laundry there, and they're so offended by it but still listening, and she just enunciates some of the crude phrases to her coworker, who's like, you shouldn't be reading that.
Right.
She's like, well, I'm going to say it louder.
So funny.
I just, like, loved it.
Yeah. Overall, I thought the acting felt really natural. I thought she fit into the role well. And again, her screaming when she's being held hostage was chilling. You know, we always call out Reese Witherspoon for her screams, but Kate Winslet's got a few good screams in her too.
Yeah. I think both Jeffrey Rush and Joaquin Phoenix's acting in this outshone hers, but I think that was also innate in their roles, but they just kind of overshadowed her a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I do think it's probably because of their roles, because theirs were so, I mean, they both had to do insane things.
Yeah. Yes.
But I especially thought Joaquin Phoenix's acting was phenomenal.
Yeah, I was surprised we didn't see his name on any of the nominations.
Yeah. Whose chemistry do you like better, Reese and Joaquin Phoenix or Kate and Joaquin?
I gotta go Reese.
Mm.
Reese and Joaquin.
I think I do too.
Yeah. Maybe it's because Reese and Joaquin are in Walk the Line and it's like telling a love story kind of. So
I was just going to say, like, maybe if it was a more traditional, yeah, a more traditional love story, maybe I would need to see that between Kate and Joaquin to like know for sure.
Yeah.
But I'm with you.
I'm not gonna lie, I'm still thinking about Kate and Alan Rickman. I think, you know,
yeah,
of both the movies we've talked about today, I think that's the chemistry I'm taking away from this.
Yeah.
So for Kate's bonus category this season, it is feistiness. We gave her 1 out of 2. We thought she was definitely feisty when she's like hitting the guy with the iron. We didn't think we could give her a full 2 in comparison to some of her other characters, but we thought she deserved some credit.
Right, right. She's got a spark.
Just the fact that she's like running a kind of underground printing operation.
Yeah, true.
It's like kind of feisty.
True. And for Would You Watch Again, we rated this a 1 out of 5. Again, I liked the movie, but I don't really feel the need to rewatch it. Maybe just because it is so crazy, I'm just like, I think I could only handle that once.
Yeah. I thought I actually might. It's really heavy content, but I also thought, well, I balanced it really well. The story overall was really good. But then how realistic it is for me to like turn this on is probably pretty low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair.
So to review for Quills, we gave the plot a 7.75 out of 10. We gave Kate's character Maddie a 6.5 out of 10. Kate's acting a 7 out of 10. A feisty score of 1 out of 2. And a Would You Watch Again score of 1 out of 5. For a total score of 23.25 out of 37 points, which means that Quills is ranked number 23 out of 46 movies, right in the middle.
Yes. And I just want to call out, if you remember, we gave A Little Chaos at the beginning of this episode a 25.75. And we gave Quills a 23.25, so pretty close scores. But the spread in where they rank, A Little Chaos is number 13, Quills is number 23. And that just gives you guys an idea of the closeness. There are so many movies that fall right within that range.
Mm-hmm.
We had such a hard time dissecting our scores so that there were not ties. But that's how close, like that's not a big point spread.
Yeah. The quarter points... I mean, I wish we had, I wish we had done quarter points and half points and stuff in our first season because yeah, we have so many ties for Jennifer Aniston's season.
So true. We've learned.
So I'm glad we don't do that anymore, but it does make it challenging when we were like, well, we have a 6-way tie and everything's really close on either side of it, so we have to figure this out.
Right, because you still want the scores to be valid.
Right, yeah. Has to be fair.
Right. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting. Not a big point spread, but a big ranking spread.
Yeah, they're so close together.
Yeah. Well, as always, thanks for listening to Girl Crush Podcast, especially this twofer episode. Let us know your thoughts on today's movies. You can find us on Instagram at girlcrush_pod or on TikTok at girlcrushpod. You can also visit our website at girlcrushpodcast.com or support us at buymeacoffee.com/girlcrushpod. Tune in next time when we'll be talking about Ammonite.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.